I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Ian Grandage. Welcome, Ian.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm in this beautiful moment at the moment where there's blue sky dreaming happening for a 22 festival. With that sense of great relief that we got to do a 2021 Perth Festival, the fact that, and feeling very sad for our colleagues in Melbourne who lost a magnificent and deep expression of what that city is and could be in their Rising Festival that was due to go up 2 weeks ago and last week.
It really is sad, and we keep talking about sort of the ravaging effect of COVID on particularly the performing arts. I should remind everybody that you are the artistic director of the Perth Festival.
I am.
And you have been for a couple of years now.
Yes, so 2020 was my first festival, and then 2021, as my dear friend and colleague Tim Minchin said, because when we were talking about the fact that COVID had changed the framework by which one can present an, in inverted commas, international arts festival, however, telling stories close to home and about this place with the bedrock of Whadjuk Noongar culture being here, that that in order to prevent myself getting bored with what a festival might be, I'd somehow manifested a global pandemic in order to make sure I stayed on my toes in programming something that was immediate. So it's not true, but it's also, it does make every festival entirely fresh because the circumstances are changing so quickly.
And one of the odd things is that has had the effect, I suppose, of indigenising in many ways festivals in Australia, but also in Western Australia, because the way things can pop up one day and you can't travel from one state to the next day, do you have to look at much more homegrown West Australian talent?
Yeah. I mean, and I've always been a great believer in that. It was central to my focus in that pre-COVID festival of 2020, it was a very strong focus, and certainly there seems to be a moment in time where that celebration of what of the power and strength and infallible maybe is the wrong word, but ubiquity of acknowledgement of the power and strength of Indigenous culture here needs to be celebrated both psychologically but and now practically because if you're going to have put a performance on here in this place, then you need to acknowledge that for millennia performances were happening in this place, and this is just the latest version of that ceremony.
Well, West Australians is a collective of Europeans, that part of them, Swan River Colony, happened less than 200 years ago. It's no time at all, so it's appropriate that we're doing this. But when it comes to festivals at a sort of more, intellectual level, we all grow up learning about the Romans and Colosseums and bread and circuses and such things. What is the role of a modern festival like the Perth Festival? Is there an easy answer to that? Do you have your own particular approach?
Yeah, I mean, I think my version of that is, because I would think that every person would have their own subjective opinion about that. But mine is that it's to help us fall more in love with this place, to see this place with different eyes, with new perspectives, wherever possible and however possible, to bring those new perspectives, to bring hidden histories to light, to bring the contemplations of artists about what we're doing and how we're living here into the foreground so that people get to enjoy the way of living here in a new and fresh way.
A festival's political... with a big P or a little P?
every choice that I think that every choice that you make in programming has certain politics inside it. It's a great question because yes, they are profoundly political, and I choose to maintain a quietness in the way I write about them and the way I speak about them, so they don't become didactic. Because I think in the entering into a conversation, you, as an audience member, discover and happen upon those things. And my hope is that I would react if I was being told what to think or what to feel, and hopefully inside a festival it's...
So in many ways, an artistic director is like a novelist or a painter, a performing artist of some sort, a cellist. They're interpreting and getting you to share and getting you to think about the world you live in.
Yeah, but it's easier being an artistic... Like, lots of bits of being an artistic director are harder, but being an artistic director is easier than being a prime creator or interpreter.
Mm.
Because though artists are the centre of what we do at the festival, and their interpretive qualities, their artistry is what we are featuring and collating and... In the bringing together and in the juxtapositions and in the conflations is where the joy is.
Now, you've got to this position relatively recently
mm-hmm.
of the Perth Festival Artistic Director, but I think you held another artistic directorship earlier than that, didn't you?
I've never done anything strategic in my life except analysing when... we were back here for a while in Perth. I lived in Melbourne for 8 years, and we were back here, and the idea of becoming of entering into this role occurred to me during Jonathan Holloway's tenure, and I went, okay, what happens if I went for that job? And I asked a few questions of a few people whom I trust around town, and they said, well, have you curated anything before? And I went, no, like I was coming to it as a practicing artist. And so I sought out and was lucky enough to get the artistic directorship of the Port Fairy Spring Music Festival, a beautiful, small chamber music festival. So in my known territory of fine music, being a cellist and a composer. And so I took that over. It's a beautiful town in the west of Victoria.
People love Port Fairy. Yes.
And fell in love with the town, and also they had a very generous board who allowed me to do anything and kind of reinvent that festival in a way that that felt like it reflected contemporary times. And that was the... Having had that experience, the board were more able to let me jump in to this job.
But your journey in getting here has taken you in so many directions. You've won all sorts of amazing awards, but does it all start with a love of music when you're younger?
Yes, I mean, and I've got to acknowledge inside that there's a privilege in my parents, neither of whom are musicians, who are, my dad's an academic, my mum's a scientist, who adored music and exposed me to music and invested their means in music lessons and instruments that allowed me and concert experiences that meant I fell in love with it.
Right.
And fell in love specifically with communal music making inside orchestras led by the late great Richard Gill.
Yes.
The West Australian Youth Orchestra. And inside those experiences, just kind of very formed. But I was also in love with storytelling. And so very quickly after that, after being in orchestras, going through an undergraduate degree in cello performance and composition, falling in love with the idea of writing music that helped tell stories. And so entered Black Swan from there, and then I was in the performing arts and writing music for theatre and dance, and then operas, and then the concert hall stage. So
all these things take in one place or another.
Mm.
So you've written music for some, as you say, for theatre, for dance, and how does one get commissioned for something like that? Take probably a more recent phenomenon, composition, the Dances with Devils, which I really enjoyed with the Wasso, and Claire Edwards, the percussionist, just a few months ago. And it's your percussion symphony. Yeah. I mean, well, there's so many questions in here. Yeah. How do you get commissioned for that? But presumably it's because you know something about percussion and you start out as a cellist. And how does all this happen? Just explain it to me.
There's a lot of bits in that question.
But, yes.
So first of all, in terms of orchestrating, and orchestrating implies that you know a lot about a lot of instruments, and one doesn't. But I distinctly remember in the mid-90s, I played inside the West Australian Symphony Orchestra, and we played the second suite of Daphnis and Chloe by Ravel, and inside that there is a sunrise. At that moment of that sunrise, I looked around the orchestra, and I distinctly remember the moment just going, I just need to know how this is put together. What is the moment as I'm sitting there playing on my cello inside this magnificent beast that is the orchestra? What is the, how's he made that sound more than the sum of those 80 musicians on stage? It's the most magnificent sound. So I go and I stare at the score and you look at how that's built. And he is rendering as many frequencies as possible at that moment that the sun rises in that work, and that arrival is filling almost the entire frequency range of human hearing. And so I went, oh, okay. And that single moment has taught me more in analysing that inside that score, taught me more about the orchestration than any lesson. And so then you go and you seek, every time you hear in an orchestra work, that moment, oh, and then you go and you look at how it's built. And in that, you see how those great orchestrators have used various instruments and when an instrument sounds in a certain way. The second part, I met Claire many, many years ago in the Australian Youth Orchestra. So we're contemporaries inside the Australian Youth Orchestra. She was always a superstar, even in those days. We then, through Tour of New Music here in Western Australia, got to play in an ensemble together with William Barton and my partner Mel Robinson and myself and Claire and Will, and we formed a little group that was glorious fun. But then I got to really know Claire's playing and got to know what made her tick as a human being. The third part is Sally Richardson, the great local artist who created a dance work called Drover's Wives. And in creating that work of Drover's Wives, she introduced me to all the Australian Gothic elements that were the stories that formed Dances with Devils. And the fourth part about a commission was an offer from the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra to go, we would like you to write a percussion concerto. And I went, knowing the strength of womanhood, which is inherent inside Claire Edwards' being, how best to represent that strength against the many. And so that's when the conflation of the idea of the other that's inherent in the Gothic tradition of one against many, of a single person against the bush, of how Sally had sewn that together in the Drover's Wife's dance work. It's a conflation of many bits.
You say conflation, but it really is a deep appreciation of all of those things, and then a masterful thing to bring it all together. Mm. But how long does something like that take from a composition point of view to realise?
The idea is one part, and that can happen quite quickly or it can happen quite slowly in terms of a resonance. So before I accept a commission, I have to go, well, what would I do for that moment? Because I've had a number of moments where I've accepted a commission and then attempted it and then had to return money because it just didn't work. I've had other moments where I've accepted a commission explored the idea and the piece has been moderately successful or barely successful. And then there's other works where you just go, oh, that really pinged.
Yes.
And Dances with Devils is one of the ones that
really pinged.
That pinged. And so I'm really interested in the idea of a long journey. It's my journey with Indigenous Australia is a long journey. I'm 25 years into that and it feels like a heartbeat. The long journey with those particular stories, that dance work that I referred to was 12 years ago. So those stories have been with me for that duration. And longer in some instances, I knew of them but didn't know them deeply. The long rumination ends up kind of allowing you to whatever's going on in the back of your head, like when you ask a question before you go to sleep and then it's answered in the morning. That's the tiniest version of it.
Very lucky. Answered in the morning. tell me this. In explaining that to me, and I think I get it, are you also wondering, are you also sort of trying to answer a question about what do contemporary Australians, however you define contemporary Australians, want to hear? Or are you trying to give them something to make them think differently? What are your objectives or your aims, your ambitions?
Yeah. Great question. I'm always writing for the performers to fall in love with something so that they can convey that love to an audience. I'm not interested in writing a work that never sees the light of day. I'm not interested in writing a work that confronts a performer in such a way that they can't communicate the fullness of themselves to it, like in the moment, i.e. I'll push them to the edge of what a technique is, but I won't push it past that. But it's always for an audience. I'm a populist from that point of view. But I'm never interested in populism overtly, i.e. for that all be smoke and mirrors, for a work to not be grounded, for a performer to not be grounded, to not be able to answer the question, but why?
Mm.
Why does this piece exist?
Yes.
You know, like, and then, I don't want it to, so I don't write many pieces, really, compared to many composers, but because and I'm increasingly writing fewer and fewer. Even before I got this job, now there's no time to write any pieces. But if I can't answer, but why, then I won't write the piece.
We'll come back to this sort of impresario role that you have as artistic director of the festival and talk a bit more about that. But you mentioned a 25-year journey with music in Indigenous Australia. How did that come about?
So I was a cellist inside the WA Symphony Orchestra. I was in a contemporary music group with Lindsay Vickery, Kathy Travers and Paul Tanner called Magnetic Pig, that was a kind of a composer ensemble. But I was offered a role in a play by Louis Nara called Cossi, and I was playing the role of Zach. So it needed to be a musician who played the piano accordion and loved Wagner. I've got to say I'm a terrible actor, but to his eternal credit, Andrew Ross, the then artistic director, the founding artistic director of Black Swan, gave me a role. But I said, look, thank you, but what I'm really interested in is writing music for theatre. And that's what we really clicked. We clicked very early on as dear friends, and he's been the most profound influence on my life. And through that, I then worked at Black Swan fairly consistently. Back in those days, it was okay because of Andrew's trusted relationship in bringing Brand New Day to life, to a broader audience. In his collaboration with Jimmy Chai, he was trusted at that stage to do the same with Corrugation Road. So then I met there the late great Jimmy Chai and the late great Stephen Bumber Albert and the late great Ning Lee Lawford. Mm. And I say in mentioning those three, inside there is an immense sadness that those people, Jimmy was an old man, Bumble was an old man, but Ning Lee far before her time.
Yes.
These people, and that is something that we're consistently up against, here in this country, and that profound injustice that many of those people who carry cultural authority and creativity are gone earlier than might be expected for a multitude of reasons.
And it's fair. Now, along the way with this involvement, you've received the Helpman Award for what? Tell us exactly what. For original scores.
Yes, so there's a few.
This is when you start to become rich and famous, is it? You start writing original scores.
So there's 7 Helpman Awards in a bag in a box in my storage unit.
And people need to know this. You didn't just win one. You've won multiple times.
Yeah. So inside that journey that I described that started with Corrugation Road, then there were a series of collaborations out in the Western Desert, and then there were a series of collaborations with Indigenous musicians in urban centres, and then also a work called The Secret River that for which I won music director and best score.
I must say, just to cut in, the quite haunting the music, The Secret River, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and that was because of how Stephen Page, in his collaborations with various Darug language speakers and singers, held a space open to allow those Indigenous voices to have a profound voice at the middle of that particular work.
Mm.
And it's complicated. My relationship with that work is complicated. It was of its time, and it feels like that time is no longer.
Mm.
So, like the speed with which First Nations work, and rightly so, is the First Nations leadership inside there. I've only done the work that I've done because that was the circumstances at the time. But there are many shows, Secret River included, The Rabbits included, and Corrugation Road, where it would now be inappropriate for me to be in those roles and
well,
I celebrate.
There's this whole question of authenticity, appropriation, and I'm fascinated by it because it's not surprising that it's happened, and it's not surprising that the way things worked in the previous couple of hundred years here in Western Australia, that it was European voices that ran everything. Mm. But how do you respond to that now from an artistic director point of view? You're in a position to commission people who know their own cultural stuff.
Yeah. And so I was certainly aware of all of those voices about what appropriation looks like, and fully celebrate First Nations ownership and direction about who, how, and where those voices get heard, and support in any way that I'm asked their ability to do so. And that's the central nature of it. And so, as we said at the beginning, like the bedrock of any ceremony in any place needs to be acknowledged, and that is First Nations work, and everything else can exist because that exists in this place.
Well, it's a beautiful outlook, Ian. Just going to the technical side of composing, we touched on it earlier in relation to dances with devils, but take something like The Rabbits or the thing that won't be repeated, The Secret River and the like. How do you, as a composer for something that's quite discreet, I think you're also involved with Cloud Street before that, you sit down and read the primary work, the novel, or be exposed to what might be a television series or something, and look for inspiration, wait for something to descend upon you? What do you do? Is there a particular technique? Because you've studied composition.
Yeah. So I have different things. I didn't study composition much. I did it a little bit in my undergraduate time. And,
right.
And fundamentally, I've been more instinctive than technical inside that. But I do separate composing. Let's talk less about a theatre context, because that's always about being responsive to a moment in time and being emotionally open to what's necessary in terms of the storytelling.
Mm.
So always, be it in The Rabbits or Sick River or Cloud Street, was me playing live, and I'm sitting there and I'm responding to what is necessary in the drama at that point. So that's a very right. Copland-esque
the kind symbol of way. The symbols suddenly have to sound.
Yeah, you know, and you are literally in support of a text and a narrative. But as a composer of, like, in Dance with Devils or those more composed things, I take in the original source material, and then I describe it at the beginning of that as opening the fountainhead and improvise about what a particular emotional state or moment might feel like. And then that from that starts to have some defined musical response. And then after that 5% of creative moment, there's 95% control, technique, analysis of what that is, picking apart what that is, and utilizing that as the basis of what a well-constructed work of music might look like, which is about musical analysis and techniques of building towards a climax, reverse engineering, or echoes past. So it's inside that technique, and you can teach that craft.
Mm.
And it is craft, it's craftspersonship. And that 5% is mysterious. that bit at the beginning, you'd like, where does it come from? Who yes. are you open to? What is yes. that moment?
Yes. Mm. Well, it's a lovely explanation. More generally, given your background in music, and a wide love of music, I'm not sure that you've sort of been the lead guitarist in a rock band, or maybe you have. But
bass player.
Yeah. Oh well. is there anything different happening in Australian music? Whether it's classical music, are we stuck with, in a sense, Mozart forever, as magnificent as he is, and I turn him on in the car because he soothes me. Are there new strands happening? We have chamber orchestras. We have very successful string quartets. We have new sounds happening. Are there any strands? Are there any themes that are discernible?
So for me, it's less in terms of ensembles and more in terms of technology. So those ensembles in increasing parts are, it's about how they're being amplified, and that amplification is being manipulated, and that's happening in very, so kind of new classical world of Max Richter and Oliver Arnold's, and in these worlds are about, you know, there might be incredibly closely mic'd felt piano that sits there. So it's actually something which is an incredibly private sound that's then brought. And then the quietitude that's around that is an amazing emotional integrity.
And is that for large audiences, or is that particularly for recorded sounds?
So inside the festival, I get to experiment with,
yes,
inside our chamber music series, which in the 21 festival we did inside Hackett Hall underneath Otto the Whale.
Which was wonderful.
I surreptitiously placed microphones amongst those performers and then ran reverb through speakers that weren't obvious, but for Hildegard von Bingen, suddenly you're operating in a 5 or 6 second acoustic, and then when you have something where you need to hear text in Songs of the Avern, then you have a much shorter acoustic, but you are messing with people's the psychology of how people are receiving it, and you go, oh, that sounds beautiful, like it's got a sheen around it, and those kind of things do feel like they are progressive in terms of how that is. There's also an entire stream of what modernism looks like and of where contemporary music looks like, which is about analysis of single sounds that people can make, and I find that thrilling to listen to, even if the audience of that is smaller.
Now, what about at a very personal level? Do you still occasionally strap a cello on the back and take it off to the workplace and comfort yourself during your lunch hour with a couple of sandwiches, or do you not get to it as often as you used to?
I don't get to it nearly as often. I do, and I do end up playing, and nearly always in environments where it's useful for me to talk to artists or donors or audience members, and then play a reflection on that. I only play music that I have control over, i.e. my own music or something that I've arranged, because I don't feel like I do other composers' music justice in the amount of practice that I've done. Therefore, can I play it in time, in tune, and appropriately? And so I don't play Bach anymore for anybody else. I do play it at home, but I wouldn't play Bach for anyone, because it's in the end, it's not, I don't have the technique remaining to honour the profound legacy that that music carries.
Let's come back as we finish to the festival, Perth Festival. I used the word ambitions earlier. Can you see it going in? Would you like to be taken in new directions? Are there new things that we, the West Australian public, can be exposed to that we've never really contemplated, perhaps have never been done in a festival anywhere?
My ambitions are giant, and they're about enacting societal change through small and large acts of community. That's where it's inside those that my populist bent lies, and it's through years of training inside fine music that my grounded integrity attempts to synthesize with that populism. So I'm consistently trying to find those unicorn moments where something has integrity, both philosophical, ethical, and technical or musical, with the fact that it can reach as many people as possible. Because unless you reach the people who you want to reach, it's silence in a forest.
Well, performing arts and particular parts of them have often attracted, or occasionally attracted, the elitist criticism. So as much as one might love opera or particular arias and the like, it still attracts that. And you mentioned the late, great Richard Gill earlier. Are there particular forms of expression of this ambition that one might imagine?
I mean, the joy is that it's a summer festival. The joy of this place is that summer is eminently suitable to outdoor presentations. Those outdoor presentations, especially in COVID times, allow more people than not. And that's why I also talk about those kind of amplified moments, because there's also ways of manipulating acoustics in outward parts. So many of the most ambitious large-scale free public events are all of those things, and about how to tell stories. So how do we tell the Catalpa escape story in a way that reaches as many people as possible? How do we tell the story that Noel Nanup says about inside the creators of everything, of wanting to emulate the Wagal lifting the sky, and that lifting of the sky as a as an allegory for hope. You do that by putting choirs on every rooftop of every building across the CBD and have people singing those songs to that sky, and that's what we'll do in 2023. How do you do that in 22? And you tell the Catalpa story, there's ambition to do a large scale free work in the throughout Fremantle that tells lots of those stories of arrival and departure, of escape and imprisonment, and of what it is to be in a world that's utterly changed by this pandemic, but inside that changing is opportunity for us to become more connected humans.
We're close to finishing. I've avoided, in a very direct sense, the pandemic. Mm-hmm. There was a time when I spoke to people like we're speaking where I'd raise it, and it seemed to be a central topic for discussion. I've now got to the position personally where I think it's always with us. Mm. Do you think it's going to affect festivals for a long time?
It is, and it will, to the degree festivals are re-entering in this European summer into an existence. I do think, I mean, I'm no epidemiologist, but I do think that once there is the sense that that vaccinations and herd immunity can allow coronavirus and COVID to exist and not be fatal to people, so it becomes equivalent to a flu, so there is dangers, there's consistent dangers around it, but those dangers can be managed with some efficacy. Then in those instances, then the international borders open, and then there is something that returns to that. But always inside what the festival does is to have this local grounding with international ambition, so that we don't become parochial. Because the danger inside a local focus is that you become inward looking, and I never want to do that.
And yet, interestingly, at the same time, being local and being proud of what one does can overcome if there's any residual cultural cringe, I suppose.
Yeah, and in terms of the response to what happened in the 21 Festival, it feels like that cultural cringe. I've been aware of a diminishment of that, and a profound diminishment of that. And part of that is allied to this near universal embracing of what Indigenous culture offers Australians more broadly, non-Indigenous Australians, and the generosity, the profound generosity, specifically of Noongar custodians, to continue to share those stories and to never take that for granted from our point of view, because it's in the continual sharing that we are now in this place where the listening is happening, and for that I'm always grateful.
Well, as you say, where the listening is happening, and it is, it's a very exciting time that we're in and lies ahead. And here we are in Fremantle. What do you make of Fremantle, Ian?
When I moved back from Melbourne, where I was for 8 years, I didn't move back to Perth. I moved back to Fremantle. Like, this is a place where there's a spot just down the road where I would love my ashes to be spread, and that's there at South Beach. It's the closest thing I've ever found to the earth that feeds me, and so it's my love for this place is complete.
Well, I'll edit the answer to that and that question out. We don't want too many people rocking up in Fremantle after all. Well, thank you for joining me today. It's been lovely meeting and talking to you, and we're all looking forward to, it'll be upon us before we know it, the 22 Festival.
I can't wait to.